Welcome to 501c3 BS, Deprogramming for Organizational Growth. I'm your host, Zoot Velasco.
We just need one big fundraiser.
Our clients are our donors.
Bigger is better.
Who cares what the mission statement is?
I work in nonprofits.
Bullshit!
In your second week as CEO of a small, quote-unquote, nonprofit, the board is made up of some titans of local industry who put in enough money and begged enough of their friends to get the board to the point of hiring you. But in their mind, they didn't hire you to lead. They hired you to manage things, because they are the board. This is their organization. And as they told you in their first board meeting, you are the staff. You handle the day-to-day. We're the board of directors and directors direct. If you have drunk the Kool-Aid on our podcast about the word nonprofits negatively affecting our industry, you believe in the power of labels to change conversations. If you haven't heard that episode with an interview with Hilde Gottlieb, go back and listen now. So now let's change the conversation on our board of directors. In the corporate world, a board of directors, according to Investopedia, is a group of individuals who are elected as representatives of the stockholders to establish corporate management-related policies and to make decisions on major company issues. But community benefit organizations, or CBOs as I'll be referring to them, haven't always had boards of directors. Until the 1970s and 80s, a CBO had a board of trustees. I could tell you about this, but let's go to the source. Today I'm interviewing Jeffrey R. Wilcox, founder, president, and CEO of the Third Sector Company. Jeffrey is former senior vice president of United Way of Greater Los Angeles and Valley of the Sun United Way in Phoenix, Arizona. He is a nonprofit columnist with the Third Sector Report, which appears in the Long Beach Business Journal. He is the past chair of Executive Transitions Affinity Group for the Alliance for Nonprofit Management, past president of the Orange County chapter of the Association of Fundraising Professionals, and a member of the Board of Directors of Advancement Northwest in Seattle. He is the 2015 Alumni of the Year by Seattle Pacific University and chairs the Executive Advisory Board of the School of Business, Government, and Economics there. Jeffrey is also a partner of Social Venture Partners in Los Angeles and Seattle and is an advisor to the Encore Fellows Program in Los Angeles. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Yes, indeed.
So before we start, Jeffrey, I just want to warn you that we had a previous podcast calling bullshit on the term nonprofit. So that's become a no-no for us. And, you know, we all use that term all the time. But I'm trying to get our guests to say social profit or social sector or community benefit organizations or some other term. If that's hard for you, you just have to drop a quarter in a bucket near you and then take your coworkers out with whatever's in the change by the end of the conversation. Does that sound good?
That's a deal. In fact, I think you'll probably find me to be one of your more better students at that nomenclature.
Good, good. So there we go. Jeffrey, my first question for you is, can you give the listeners an amazing lesson that you gave me on about how the industry changed from one that was based around mission to becoming one that mimicked the corporate structure? And you had some great stories about that in terms of the way we use the term board of directors versus board of trustees and walks and runs and all of those kinds of things. Could you just give us that you gave me in class so long ago so well?
Well, I'm happy to do that because it is the foundation of how ordinary people came together to do extraordinary things for the communities of this country. And it certainly was not through a structure of a proprietary organization. These were men and women who saw something they wanted to contribute to the quality of life of other people and themselves, their children and their future descendants. And they chose a method of doing it in a way in which they would, number one, create a community asset as opposed to a privately held asset. And that means that for organizations that would eventually provide social benefit, they had to earn the trust as stewards that they were working on a set of collective values that they were going to advance, and they wanted other people to join them. They were men and women who were on a mission. And what we find today is there's the organizational point of view and there's the cause point of view. And Zoot, I think what you're alluding to is people who are advancing a cause as opposed to overseeing a body are two different kinds of groups of people. One is rooted in recognizing that their purpose and their responsibility and their accountability is to sustain, grow, and earn the trust of a diverse group of stakeholders. A set of board of directors are a group of people who are kind of overseeing their investment, if you will, in a proprietary point of view. Great causes are non-proprietary. Great causes are held by groups of people And we in leadership positions have a responsibility to A, advance the cause, B, empower folks to earn the trust of others to come along, and C, to be able to say to ourselves that we created a social profit first rather than a financial profit.
Well said. Talk a little bit about board of trustees versus board of directors.
Well, in the early days of the not-for-profit sector, the generally accepted designation between people who served on boards of corporations and boards who served on and people who served on boards that were non-proprietary or social benefit, Zudafi, you and I were walking down the street with one another, and I said, you know, how are you doing? And you said, I'm doing great because I've just been named to the board of directors. I think people generally in society would have said to you, well, Zud, that's wonderful. For what company? And then if you return the question to me and said, Jeffrey, what's going on in your world? And I said, well, Zud, I've been named to the board of trustees. Generally, you would have thought, well, for what charitable organization or for what, you know, social advancement opportunity are you doing that for? In the Great Depression, what happened was is there was this perception that the men and women who lead not-for-profits were unsophisticated, that if we would just run nonprofits like businesses, we'd all be better off. And so that mindset said, well, stop this trustee business and, you know, take on the corporate feeling of a board of directors. What happened from that is people came in and started directing, and what we lost in society was the men and women who came to the core of a mission, and their primary role is to build the trust of the community that this was an asset worth protecting, growing, and nurturing.
You have a really great philosophy about how that changed and when that changed. I remember you telling us about the March of Dimes and how that became the Watson rise of today. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, many people probably don't know the history of the March of Dimes, but it's an example that I use very often. In this country, we had a disease that people didn't catch. What we talked about was a disease that people were stricken with, and primarily children. I also use this example because my family, my brother, was one child who was stricken with polio. And the pictures of people coming together to stop this disease that was out of control, and was seeing parents finding their children losing all muscle ability and being taken to a children's hospital and put into something called an iron lung, was an incredible call to action. And a group of people said their mission statement was very clear. We've got to eradicate a disease. What was also incredible was the mothers and fathers, and this included my own, when their child was stricken, somebody showed up at that hospital and held onto somebody's hand and said, you don't know me, but I know how you feel. And a connectedness began to be created in a state of emergency. And the enemy in all of this was an unknown and very scary virus that we had no idea where it came from. And so we marched. We marched and we said, we've got to raise the money to stop this thing from happening in our country. And thanks to the Mother's March Against Polio, we had the invention of the polio vaccination and Jonas Salk. But these folks didn't stop there. They realized that by coming together, even people can stop scientific realities that affect us as human beings. And when the mission of eradicating polio had been achieved, what occurred then was, what do we do next? And the March Against Birth Defects was born. The Mother's March Against Polio and the cause that it created in the community of people who reached out to one another in a form of care and money led to the development of the March of Dimes. Great social organizations play a part in evolution. And their mission statements, when they're fulfilled, give us the courage and the willpower to say, what's next? And I think that's part of the joy of being in this sector.
Yes. And, you know, I remember... After your talk, when we were having our trainings, I would go back and I would look things up and I would think about things. And, you know, one of the things that I remember is that people in the days before, say, the 1960s or 70s, when charitable organizations really were on a mission, they had uniforms. They had, people were at war with something. People were really trying to change, like you say, move the needle, trying to change the world in a particular way. And they were marching for it, and they were directors entrusted with a mission, and they were, they were trustees entrusted with a mission. And they were really doing something, and we've kind of lost that power. I remember you saying, you know, people don't march anymore. They walk the things. They run the things. It doesn't have the same urgency to it.
That's exactly right. That's one example of, if you look at the evolution of our sector, some things that have dramatically changed, and in my opinion, not for the good. I'll give you another example. The idea of special events. If you look at our sector, special events have become inside a group of walls with a podium talking about a particular statement, and people go home. in the early days of the not-for-profit, I'm sorry, I caught me, there's my quarter.
That's a quarter.
There's a quarter. In the early days of, you know, men and women who were focused on social benefit, they didn't have special events. What they had was rallies. I am constantly challenging the leaders of our sector to stop having events and going back to having rallies. People need to be rallied behind the idea of how important it is that arts and humanities be accessible to all. That we have to rally people around the idea that our environment is much more fragile than we are acting. And that doesn't require a sit-down dinner. What that requires is a stand-up advocacy effort. So one difference between the good old days and today is we've moved from having rallies to having special events. Another example is today we talk about the marketing plan or the communications plan. And in the early days, we didn't have marketing communications plans. What we had was campaign plans. Men and women and children and people from all walks of life were invited to be part of a campaign. And there's no question that marketing and communications, as well as a whole bunch of other functions, go into a successful campaign. But what I've seen in my career, Zoot, is we've institutionalized and business-liked our causes that we now start having functional plans. And what we had in the good old days is we had one big old plan that was called our campaign against polio, our campaign for ending a social injustice, and everything fell underneath that.
I was so jazzed when I heard you talk about these things, and they would come up in almost every class of ours. You were always very good about centering us back around the mission, and I would leave thinking, that's what we need. We need to march for things. We need to have uniforms. And by uniforms, I mean, you know, it could be a T-shirt, it could be a logo, but we need to, like, identify ourselves
right
as, from this cause, and being a cause on the mission, doing things to change the world, to move the needle, to have rallies, to have campaigns. These are all great things. I love that you frame things this way. And you're really one of the only people I've heard talk about this, and I think everyone needs to start talking about it.
You're so complimentary. You know, I'm just doing like everybody else the thing I love the most. But having done this for a few years and my career with United Ways in major cities in this country, I've seen what social benefit organizations have done to themselves. And it saddens me because as a person who has a background in funding, I think typically my funding head on tells me I want dollars to be a mobilization effort. I don't want dollars to be a institutional building effort. And I just saw a lot of requests for investments that wasn't moving the needle. It was actually building the entity. And I think all of us have to recognize that those organizations that were put in business for a social benefit, we don't give to them. We give through them. And when you get to the point where you have a fundraising message that says give to us, it changes the lens of this is what happens to the world when you give through us. We are a means. We are not an end. And when the fundraising message is about give to us because we're the end all, you lose the impact of social benefit because these organizations are meant to be, in my opinion, a catalyst that you give through so you can see the tangible change external to the walls as opposed to internal to the walls.
Well said. Well said. Yeah, I remember as a kid, and you know, I guess I'm dating myself a little bit here, but I remember seeing the Salvation Army downtown in their uniforms, dressed up, and you know, not just ringing bells, but they were delivering food. They were, you know, opening thrift stores. They were doing things, but they were in uniform and they were on a mission. And you could really get a sense that they were on a mission against poverty, and they were trying to do something mm-hmm. in a very big way. And I looked up the founding of the Salvation Army. It was one of the first social benefit organizations in the world, and it started in England from this preacher who was upset because his congregation wouldn't allow the poor or the drunks or the prostitutes into the church.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is counter everything that we learned that Christ taught us. So he decided to leave and start the Salvation Army, and it became a worldwide organization because he instilled that sense of mission. And I think that's what's missing today. When you see a new nonprofit get started, it gets started. Sorry, now I got to put a quarter in the jar. When a social benefit organization gets started, it gets started because of the fact that somebody's trying to save a historic home that's being torn down, or there were the riots in Los Angeles and people wanted to leave from that with a better world and make a better tomorrow. So, you know, there's all these great causes that get started and then they become organizations and they lose the cause.
You're absolutely correct. I truly believe that one of the litmus tests between a social benefit organization that is growing and thriving and the social benefit organization that is struggling. Number one, you look at their mission statement. If the mission statement talks about what they do versus what they want to have happen in the world, you already know the difference. Because a mission statement that talks about what we do is not talking about the responsibility of a cause, which is a movement towards something and is an outcome. A lot of organizations write mission statements that are process-based. We teach, we train, we do all this great stuff. A cause, if we go back to the Mother's March Against Polio, their cause had two words, eradicate polio. Any questions? And right. they didn't talk about we do this and we do this and we do this. We're focused on a mission. Any questions?
And you could see that in really good or new organizations that have very great success, like Charity Water or TED. You know,
uh-huh.
They're successful because they have a very simple mission and they're really driven by it.
That's right. You've raised also a very good point that I think that we forget, regardless of our religious upbringing. The idea of social benefit organizations have a mission is one of the most clearest results of recognizing that our sector was born out of religious movements. The first social benefit organizations that served communities as the Westward Movement occurred in the United States was men and women who faith who wanted to build hospitals, build schools, orphanages, food banks, create infrastructures in communities that were just forming. Denver, Colorado is probably one of the best examples of how people of faith had to build non-proprietary institutions to form a community basically out of nowhere. And I always find it interesting that even the most non-religious people have to recognize that they know that the men and women who carried out these common set of values to make life better for others were known as missionaries. So isn't it interesting that we operate in a sector where it is our practice that great social benefit organizations are on a mission, and we tend to forget that the folks who become part of that are by default missionaries.
Yeah, and it's funny because I teach now, you know, you taught me and now I teach. And when I teach, I, you know, use the fact that if you want to create a great nonprofit, whether you are Christian or Muslim.
Hey, put a quarter in that till, bud. Yes.
Yes. I owe another quarter. Right. Now I'm up to 50 cents. If you want to create a great social benefit or community benefit organization, you have to kind of follow the model of what I think are the greatest 501c3s in the world, which is, you know, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, you know.
Yes,
people were really good at spreading their faith and spreading their mission. And if we could emulate what they did in terms of evangelizing our mission, we'll be very successful.
Most cities, and of course I'm from the West, so I don't have the deep Eastern roots that other participants in your call may, but it's very clear to see in Western cities, in the city of Los Angeles, the very first, what we would have called in those days, 501c3 social benefit organization, was established by the Jewish communities of the West Coast. The social benefit organizations in Salt Lake City were absolutely a manifestation of the Latter-day Saint community. You also saw that in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which was absolutely the Catholic settlers built the infrastructure of social benefit organizations in Albuquerque. If any major city in the country were to look at the genesis of their social benefit organizations, they're going to find a group of people who had like-mindedness about a quality of life they wanted to create for each other, and it has a religious roots.
Absolutely. Well, Jeffrey, I have one more question for you. I don't want to keep you too long, but I wanted to let you know, I'm going to give you the question that's going to set you free. So this podcast is all about kind of letting us vent a little bit about those things in our sector that we can call bullshit on, those things in our sector that people do, and usually it's the 80% of organizations that don't get the money, you know, and they're not getting the money because they're doing everything wrong, and they're doing the way they were trained, which is completely backwards, and we get to call bullshit on it in this. So I'd like to ask you, is there anything you would like to call bullshit on? What is the thing that drives you the craziest in our sector?
Zoot, that's a very easy one. I am tired of the bullshit of what I will call the scarcity mentality as opposed to the abundance mentality. And what really ticks me off is groups of people who want to do something and feel victimized because their glass is constantly half full. And half empty. Let me be clear on this. I mean, they're always acting from the glass is half empty. And we know in society at a time when women couldn't vote, when gay and lesbians couldn't marry, that when we wanted to see something happen as a society, we started with the glasses always half full and tried to recognize what limited assets we have, we are going to use those to the fullest to make something happen. And I have just sat around so much of my career and watched people talk about what we don't have and whining about it as opposed to looking at the great organizations that occurred in this country were people who said, we don't have much, but what we've got, we're going to use it to the fullest. And those are the organizations that are thriving because they appreciated what they had as opposed to getting together and mourning about what they don't.
This is really bizarre because I interviewed Hilde Gottlieb, who is the person who came up with the term community benefit organization.
Yes.
And Hilde and I had a great conversation, and I asked her what she would call bullshit on, and she said, people moaning about not having enough resources, there's plenty of resources there.
Right.
You not have enough money, but this is America, and there's plenty of resources here for you to do your mission. It's not always about money. And you said almost the exact same thing, so it's really interesting that you're both on the same wavelength there. And I agree totally that people get so caught up in fundraising, that they forget what their mission is. Right now, I'm teaching a class at Charity How To webinars.
The
class is on program design. And my point in putting out the class was to say, hey, if you're good at program design, this is what delivers your mission, then you'll be able to get funding or, you know, your resources or whatever you need for the program if you're good at designing it. And nobody wants to take the program design class, but if I were to couch it as a grant writing class or a fundraising class, everybody would flock to it. And that's part of the problem in our sector is that people only want to deal with fundraising. They don't want to deal with the things that create their mission. They just want fundraising for it without knowing what it is or how you, you know, design it or deliver it.
I couldn't agree more. And in your introduction, you know that I've sat on boards and led local chapters of the Association of Fundraising Professionals throughout my career. And one of the things that bothers me significantly, and I'm going to put this in the BS department if given the chance here, is another piece of BS, is that fundraising is not financing. And we have moved as a sector to look at the science of human generosity. I'm sorry, the art of human generosity is the science of organizational financing. And the problem is that the amount of assets that it takes for a social benefit organization to actually create social benefit lies in other assets in addition to money. The fundraising industry is moving into a financing industry, and I'm very upset about that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. It's all about how we can get more money. And you see some of the large organizations, like, you know, you mentioned the March of Dimes. If you look at their 990 today, I think 22% of their money goes to getting more money, you know, and that doesn't make you feel too good as a funder, or sorry, as an investor, if you're going to put money into them, you know, knowing that 20 cents of every dollar, 22 cents of every dollar is just going to get more money instead of going to missions.
Well, what I'll say is, if we can create a new generation, and I am very excited by what I'm seeing in the new generation, if we can create a new generation who is basically saying, we have a sector here that hasn't moved the needle to our liking, we're going to do it a different way, I find that pretty exciting. There is an entrepreneurial infusion that's occurring in the third sector that keeps this old man invigorated and feeling very youthful.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that Hilde said when we talked about this was that she is very encouraged by the social enterprise movement.
Yes.
And she thinks eventually a lot of people will create for-profits that are doing nonprofit work, you know, doing social enterprise, social benefit work, and that there'll be a blurred line and there'll be no more line between who is for-profit and who is 501c3, that it will just all be one big happy family of people helping people. And I think that's a great kind of utopic view to get to.
Well, and I dare have to say, when I left the United Way, that was my idea in starting an entrepreneurial venture that I currently do, with that mindset. It's not been easy, and you actually are looked down upon by those individuals who are in the social sector for having created a social enterprise, but I truly am trying to do exactly what you've just described.
Well, that's a great segue, because my last question is to ask you, tell us more about the third sector company.
Well, thanks for that. After all of my years in funding, I saw two things that I just couldn't get my arms around and decided to do something about. The first one was the lack of succession planning in not-for-profit organizations. I just earned another quarter. Was the lack of succession planning in social benefit organizations. I saw strategic plans that had devoted lots of page to financial capital development, and I was not finding good thought in strategic plans that were also looking at human capital development. And I got to say, a human capital is not something you can just write a check for. The second thing I saw, Zoot, was men and women who had devoted their lives to incredible social causes had a bad day with their board chair, and they were kicked to the curb, and their careers were ruined. And those are community assets that all of us can have a bad day and all of us can make a mistake. But I saw too many people who were losing their careers when our communities needed them the most. I brought together people who had been, for whatever reason, falling outside of the sector and said, we're going to create ways for you to become interim leaders and provide transformational leadership and encourage succession planning. My organization, the Third Sector Company, its mission is leadership continuity, because I'm thoroughly convinced without leadership continuity, you don't have to worry about financial continuity. You won't need it.
That's true. That's very good. So you're focused now on developing the human capital for community benefit organizations.
That's correct. The talent pipeline is more important to me than the dollar pipeline, because that actually was the history of the social benefit organization, was to prepare the next generation to take over from the current one, to keep moving forward in something we all believed was important for society.
Well, sure. And if you have people who are good leaders and you're developing good leaders, everything else will fall into its place.
Exactly right.
Well,
and one of the pieces of BS is that somehow we started developing business leaders to automatically think they could be community leaders, and that has since proven to be wrong. You can be a good business leader, but it takes a whole different skill set to be a good community leader, and that was something that I wanted to make a contribution to.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and it's something we may do another podcast on, but it is absolutely true that people come over from the business sector and think, oh, I started a small business. I can just plug myself into a community benefit organization, and I'll do great. And it's
right.
Not the same thing. There's a lot of differences in terms of your ROI is about community benefit. And people who come from the business sector, they think their ROI is to make a profit at the end of the day. Or
right.
They're all concerned about the financial capital, as you say, not the human capital.
Right. Love to talk to you about that again at a future time, Zoop.
As you can see from how eloquently Jeffrey put it, being a board of directors is quite a different job than a board of trustees. Unsuccessful CBOs see their board of directors, who call the shots, keep their staff in line, and have all the big ideas, because that is what they do in the corporate world. Boards of directors direct. A board is there for the shareholders, which they see as their donors and funding partners. We have to be sure our donors' money is well spent, they'll tell you. The problem with this kind of thinking starts with the idea that board members are the boss. In the corporate world, boards are populated by CEOs of other companies. They are there to provide a brain trust to the CEO from his or her peers. Everyone in the room knows the business of corporate earning. They are protecting shareholders. In a CBO, none of this is true. Very few board members come from running other CBOs. Most come from the corporate model that runs on the financial profit paradigm. Most board members sit on other boards. They think that with their business experience and their other board experience, this makes them experts on running a CBO. This perception is often reinforced by a lack of training. Most boards of smaller nonprofits never go through board training to dispel these myths. In the end, we end up with a board made up of corporate greats with lots of great corporate experience who think their job is to translate that to a CBO and help the CEO run it. And because these organizations don't usually have term limits and don't follow their bylaws, they stay for decades and become obstacles for any real change, allowing these CBOs to die on the vine or just wither away until the whole generation is gone from the earth. Or at least it just seems that way. Well, compare that to what happens in a large CBO in the top 20% with effective boards. In these CBOs, boards go through a vetting process, regular training, and peer review process. They have term limits and bylaws that they actually follow. This is a board of trustees entrusted with a mission. They don't take it as their job to be the boss or direct anyone. They have learned that the board is equal to the CEO in the same way that Congress is equal to the president for a balance of power. No one board member has any more power than anyone else at the organization. Their power is only as a group. They don't impose their will on anyone or force programs onto the staff. They work in consensus to fix issues that arise in the organization that they are uniquely qualified to help fix. An employee issue needs an appeals process. It goes to the board. A capital project needs a plan and campaign which the board helps devise with staff. They create fundraising and marketing help based on staff requests. They work with staff and other stakeholders to create a strategic business plan. And they all give to the mission, and they all volunteer for the mission in some way. Everyone is engaged with a gift of one or all of the three T's, time, talent, or treasure. Each has put the organization in their estate plans. Each is recruiting their replacement as part of a succession plan. The board is diverse, not just in ethnicity, but also in age, gender, and socioeconomic group. Trustees are recruited not for their cronyism, but for their ability to fill organization needs and their trusted skills. One would likely find a 75-year-old banker sitting next to a 30-year-old web designer. A 35-year-old alumnus of the program acts as a secretary, while a 65-year-old social butterfly plans out events with staff and the board committee. The trustees commit to quarterly trainings, regular attendance, and volunteering at events, and an annual stakeholders retreat where they plan the year with staff and key investors. They hold an annual meeting for the CBO's patrons and publish an annual report. They don't always agree and allow space for respectful debate. They understand it is only through debate that democracy happens and great ideas rise to the top. They include staff in their debates because staff are the experts. They follow Robert's Rules of Orders to have orderly and efficient meetings. Because of their training, they realize they are not experts on CBOs, but because they are getting training, they are becoming experts on them. They realize that the community benefit organization's ROI comes in community benefit, not financial profit. Their job is to make sure the staff have balanced the books and return more benefit to the community for each dollar. And if there is trouble, the trustees are not the point figures or see who can be fired. Their job is to work together to fix the problem at the source. In short, a successful board does not direct. They are trustees. They work on the community's behalf to further the mission through fundraising, policy, planning, vision, and oversight with the staff, not over the staff. When I think back at my 32-year career in the social sector, every job I left ended because of issues with the board. The board is the only thing at an organization that a CEO doesn't have the power to fix. Every time, it was avoidable. Some were horror stories, including illegal and illicit acts. Others were just lack of respect issues. When employees in America were polled as to what is most important to them in their job, pay ranked somewhere around number 7. Number 1 is always Aretha Franklin's number 1 record, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, respect. If one doesn't feel respect by bosses and peers, it's very hard to enjoy work. Great teams work together. Families work together when things get tough. They can dislike each other's choices, disagree with each other's point of view, but they have respect. Without that, they are starting from below zero. If you have a dysfunctional board, you may need some help. You will need to bring in a professional expert consulting firm like Jeffrey and the Third Sector to do board training and teach them that their job is not to direct, but to work in partnership. Maybe some theater improv classes might help. They can learn to loosen up and learn the rules of theater improv. In theater improv, you never say no. I remember once hearing a nonprofit, and I used that word intentionally, a nonprofit executive say, "The most important thing we can do is say no." That is bullshit. I had a great mentor once tell me, always find a way to say yes. That was great advice. And in theater improv, if you want to further the scene in a positive and successful way, you must share the light and say yes and. That allows others to move forward. Success depends upon trust and teamwork. Boards and CEOs both need to learn to say yes and. A board of directors' job is to direct, no. A board of trustees' job is to trust. Thank you for listening to this episode of 501c3 BS, Deprogramming for Organizational Growth. I am your host, Zoo Velasco. You can find us on Twitter at 501c3bs, on our website at 501c3bs.org, or at zootvelasco.com. Become a follower to our podcast. The music is provided to us by the traditional Brazilian choral music group, Grupo Falso Baiano, and Amy Molinelli. You can find them at grupofalsobaiano.com. There'll also be a link from our website. Thanks for listening, and have a great day free from BS.